You're listening to The Hudson River, a weekly half-hour program about the nature, culture, and beauty of one of America's great waterways. The Hudson River is produced at Vassar College and brought to you in cooperation with this radio station. I'm your host, Mark Breslov. Coming up, we learn about the return of the endangered peregrine falcon to the cliffs and bridges of the Hudson Valley. We listen to a song about the vanishing farmland along the Hudson. And we visit a section of the Upper Hudson in the Adirondacks. All this and more next on the Hudson River. On this week's Hudson River Culture segment, old-timey musician Will Welling talks about how the changing status of farmland in the Hudson Valley inspired his song, The Fields.
I was driving from the Hudson Valley out to the Battenkill Valley in Vermont, over to Pownal, Vermont, and it was a nice little ride where you kind of climb out of the lowlands of the Hudson by Troy and go up an elevation, and I was riding through the town of Brunswick and noticing the fields to the left and right, cornfields and former cornfields, and just noting how a lot of the fields were being eroded by real estate development. And it sort of touched me a little bit, and I had a tune running through my head, fragments of a tune, so I pulled over and started taking down some notes of this melody. And then later on, developed it and titled it The Fields. And it's a nice little fiddle tune, and it's a little bit irregular in its timing and so forth. I've never used it for a dance because it's what's known as a crooked tune. It's short a couple of beats, kind of like the way the farmland is becoming in short supply, I guess.
What does farmland mean to you as a musician?
Well, I mean, we all appreciate the beauty of farmland, and we all need farmland because our crops come from farms. I grew up in a community that had agriculture as part of its base, and as I grew up and went through high school, more and more land left agriculture and was developed for particularly housing. So it's a sense of loss, you know, the barns falling down or the real estate coming in and taking some of the prime land, not all of it, but some of it. There's a nostalgia, I think, for the lost farmland, but, you know, a lot of farmland in the Hudson Valley is still under cultivation and being used, but none of us know for how long.
Thank you. Next on this week's Hudson River feature, wildlife biologist Barbara Laux talks about peregrine falcons along the Hudson and the story of their remarkably successful restoration from the brink of extinction. Laux works with the Endangered Species Unit of the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. In the first segment, she talks about how these birds sound, how their population has changed, and where they can be found along the Hudson. Why don't we start by talking a little bit about how peregrine falcons sound?
Well, they have a variety of calls depending on, the purpose of the call, the time in the nesting season. But probably the call most people hear if they approach a nest site would be sort of a long, screeching, aggressive call.
Okay, and do the young sound differently?
Yes. Well, the young have a distinctive food cry you hear when they're in the nest begging for food. And again, I'm not a good imitator. But once you hear it, you don't forget it.
How has the population of peregrines on the Hudson over the last century changed?
Well, peregrines were wiped out due primarily to DDT residues, so that there weren't any peregrines along the Hudson or in New York State by the early 1960s. And then starting in 1988 in the Hudson River Valley, they came back to the Tappan Zee Bridge. A few years prior to that, in 1983, they came back to New York State down in New York City at the Verrazano Narrows and the Throgs Neck Bridge. So the population in the Hudson River Valley has grown steadily. And for a number of years, we just had the Tappan Zee Bridge pair along the Hudson. But then around 1994, we started getting new pairs every year until we have pairs on every bridge from Albany south to New York City, pretty much.
So does that include a pair on the George Washington? And can you actually enumerate the bridges?
Yeah, we have pairs on the Tappan Zee Bridge, the Newburgh Beacon Bridge, the Kingston-Rhinecliffe Bridge, the Mid-Hudson Bridge, the Rip Van Winkle, the Castleton on Hudson Bridge, Bear Mountain, and a bridge in Albany, the Dunn Memorial. The bridges in New York City area, the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, the Throgs Neck, the Outer Bridge Crossing, Marine Parkway, Goffles, George Washington, Bayonne.
So it sounds like the answer to the question of where can peregrines best be seen along the Hudson is at a parking spot near basically any bridge crossing.
Yeah.
Now, do they also occur on cliffs and along the banks of the Hudson, or is it always bridge-oriented?
Well, we had a pair on a cliff that was active for several years, and we think they've moved now to Storm King. And we also have a couple pairs a little further inland from the river.
Mm-hmm. There was a nest for a while, wasn't there, on Breakneck Ridge? Is that the one that
right,
moved?
Right, that's the one that we believe the pair might have moved to Storm King. They don't seem to have been active at Breakneck.
Now let's go back to the population question. For a period of time in the 60s, there were none on the Hudson River, at least.
Right.
But what was it like before then, in their previous heyday?
Well, they nested a lot on the cliffs closer to New York City along the Palisades, and we're still actually hoping that they will return to some of those spots that are still suitable. But they weren't as much a bridge nester as a cliff nester back then. Of course, some of those bridges didn't exist, so that's why, but population in the lower Hudson Valley, basically along cliffs, a series of cliffs, and there were about 8 eyries in that area that were studied by the Herberts, and they basically observed those probably from 1930 till the early 60s. And they had records going back from literature to probably 1877. In the 19th century, there were, as I mentioned, probably about 8 eyries along a 55-mile stretch of cliffs from New York City to Storm King. And there were a few eyries in New York City then. And basically, those eyries declined. Again, the population being strongly affected by DDT residues, and also at some of those eyries, disturbance, persecution, just the habitat became unsuitable. And then what you've seen is after the banning of DDT and the restoration program, the release of the captive raised birds obtained from Cornell, is sort of a shift. We don't know of as many cliff nesting pairs, but the population has grown so that they're nesting more on these bridges along the river. And also the New York City population has really increased dramatically.
Let's talk a little bit about the decline. I mean, how did DDT affect the decline of peregrines?
The DDT residues, DDE, basically caused eggshell thinning, which led to the eggs breaking under the incubating adults. And eventually, no young were raised, so there was no replacement population for the adults as they got older.
So on a statewide basis, or in rough terms, what was the population like pre the effects of DDT, and then how bad did it get, and where is it in general now?
Well, historically, pre the decline, there were around 40 to 50 historic peregrine eyries in New York, mainly on cliffs, and then a couple different New York City building nesting pairs. By the early 1960s, none were still active due to DDT effects. And of course, this didn't just occur in New York, but other places. And then we embarked on this restoration effort, getting birds, captive raised young, mainly from the Peregrine Fund. From 1974 through 1988, we hacked about 168 captive raised falcons. And in 1983, the birds started coming back to New York, down in New York City, which surprised us. We thought maybe they'd come back to the Adirondacks. We hacked a little in New York City and the Shawangunk Mountains, but most of the hacking was done in the Adirondacks. There was also some city hacking done in Albany. But many of the release sites were cliffs in the Adirondacks, but they decided to come back to New York City. And the population has grown since then, so that in 2001 we had 48 territorial pairs, 45 bred, and 41 were successful in raising 96 young.
It is pretty close to the historic population.
Yes. I mean, the historic population is sort of a guesstimate because there wasn't any one person or group that was trying to really survey quite as intensively as we try to, although I'm not saying that we know of all the nests because I'm sure we don't.
We're speaking with wildlife biologist Barbara Laux of the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. She's told how peregrine falcons sound, how their population has changed, and where they can be found along the Hudson. To learn more about anything you hear on this program, visit us at www.hudsonriver.vassar.edu. Coming up on the Hudson River, the eco-calendar, the Hudson River soundscape, and more. Next, we'll continue our interview with Laux, where she describes the process of hacking, the release of captive-raised birds into the wild from human-made nests. She'll also describe how the success of that effort means that wild-born peregrines are now nesting and ways that you can watch them.
Hacking is a falconry term. It means when people feed and care for young birds of prey until they can become independent and hunt on their own. And basically, it involves a hack box set up somewhere, often on a cliff, and we'll have two hack-site attendants live there for several months. And the young peregrines arise from the captive breeding facility when they're about a month old, and they're held in the box until they're ready to fly at about 6 weeks of age. And then they basically stick around for a while they gradually improve their hunting skills and aren't dependent on the people, the hack site attendants, for food anymore. And eventually, enough of them survived to breed. They breed at
generally around age two. Once in a while you get a one-year-old bird breeding, but it's generally age two. So after many years of hacking, we started seeing these birds come back and breed. And by 1988, we felt that we had enough pairs surviving breeding in New York State that we wanted to shift our attention to protecting, managing those pairs, looking for new pairs, and didn't feel that the releases were necessary anymore.
And so the population growth that's occurred since then is a result of descendants of those original hacked birds as well as influx of birds from other states?
Definitely from other states' hacking programs, because of course the birds don't recognize state boundaries, so some of our birds have gone and nested other places, and other people's hack birds have come and nested here.
So we may have stolen some, so to speak, from Pennsylvania, huh?
Well, I prefer to think of it as a friendly exchange. I mean, you know, we've got New York birds nesting in different places too, so.
But some of the population regrowth has occurred from descendants of the original hacked pairs?
Right.
Now, what do you think accounts for the tremendous success that the New York Department of Environmental Conservation has had in bringing the peregrine back from the brink of extinction?
Well, I think the Peregrine Fund developed the idea originally, and I think it was it started out as an experiment, but it was basically a sound experiment. I think we've been surprised, though, over the years by, for example, the tremendous growth in the New York City population. Of course, there are opportunistic birds, and the food sources and the proper habitat for nesting is what has led to their success. The abundance in the cities of food, of pigeons, and other avian prey, and the willingness of the building owners and the bridge authorities to accommodate them is extremely important to the continued growth of the population. These sites, especially on the bridges and the buildings, need management, need protection. If it weren't for the ability to alter projects and contract work, the sandblasting, the painting, all those kind of activities that are necessary to keep the bridge in good condition and safe, all that has to be arranged with the birds in mind.
Now, what about the banning of DDT, though?
The restoration program could not have taken place without the environment believed to be clean enough to attempt that restoration. That gets back to the original soundness of the idea of hacking to begin with. By the early 70s, DDT was banned, and by the mid-70s is when the hacking started in the East. And, you know, it was an experiment. It was thought that the environment would be clean enough to support a population, and the gamble paid off.
I was reading a description of the most spectacular behavior that they exhibit with a spiraling flight and sometimes touching in midair, etc. If someone wanted to see that, how would they do that?
I think there's spectacular aerial acrobatics they perform that people could see when they're hunting, for one thing. If you observe a nesting pair, hopefully you'll get lucky and see some hunting. And they do some spectacular dives on prey and chases after prey. And the young, as they're learning to fly, interact with the adults a lot. There's talon touching that takes place when they're transferring food to each other. And again, when the young are learning to fly and chasing after the adults. And so all that's pretty neat behavior to watch, too.
When is the best time to see peregrines?
Well, during the nesting season is a great time to see a lot of activity. And because so many of these sites, especially in the city and even some of these bridges, are, you know, in the middle of people, it provides good viewing pretty much from April through July.
Well, let's talk about the webcams.
That's a great way for people that can't get down to an actual site to be able to see some of the behavior, at least at the box. Obviously, they can't really see the flights away from the box, but it gives them a glimpse into the nesting behavior, and it's pretty amazing.
We've been speaking with Barbara Laux about the remarkable recovery of peregrine falcons along the Hudson. For a link to the webcams at peregrine nest sites, visit us at www.hudsonriver.vassar.edu.
From the Almanac, January 10th, 2001, Battenkill, Hudson River Mile 188. I was on a ridge at dawn, overlooking the Battenkill, watching for early morning eagle activity. My vista was about a mile and a half east of the river's confluence with the Hudson. As the sun rose in the east and the full moon set in the west, two birds engaged in aerial combat tumbled toward me. First, I thought some type of sparrow was being harassed by a small hawk, but as I got closer, I realized that a mourning dove was desperately trying to escape a male peregrine falcon. As they passed overhead, the dove banked north and escaped. A while later, I watched an adult bald eagle unsuccessfully attack a small group of mallards. Not a good day for the predators. This observation was contributed by Craig Thompson. I'm Batsheva Ghez.
The Hudson River Almanac is an annual natural history journal compiled from the contributions of over 1,700 volunteers. Links on how to contribute materials or obtain copies are at www.hudsonriver.vassar.edu.
Time for the Hudson River Eco Calendar. I'm Sean Anderson. Talking benches, cooking grills shaped like animals, sculptural binoculars, and films aboard a floating cinema are among the outdoor artworks unfolding over the next 2 years along an 80-mile stretch of the Hudson between Bear Mountain and Albany, New York. Watershed, the Hudson Valley Art Project, is a pilot program of about a dozen commissioned public artworks sponsored by Minetta Brook, a nonprofit arts organization. For more information, contact area code 845-831-4129. That's 845-831-4129. The Hudson River Rama is a new permanent exhibition at the Hudson River Museum in Yonkers. The 2,500-square-foot installation features recreations of forest, marsh, and estuary ecosystems, live fish, interactive computers, videos, and a 31-foot-long, three-dimensional topographic model of the river valley. For more information, call 914-963-4550. That's 914-963-4550. But if you feel like actually getting out on the river, the Hudson River National Estuarine Research Reserve is sponsoring a series of canoe trips to some of the river's biggest marshes in New York State. These include Stockport Flats, Iona Island, and Tivoli Bay. Trips include paddles devoted to learning about fish or history, and even an evening paddle. Trips are free and open to the public, though reservations are required. And you needn't have your own boat, as canoes, paddles, and safety gear are provided. For more information, call the Hudson River National Estuarine Research Reserve at 845-758-7016. That's 845-758-7016. Another great opportunity to get out on the river is quickly approaching with the third annual Great Hudson River Paddle. From July 3rd to the 12th, paddlers will make the voyage from Albany to New York City to celebrate the Hudson Greenway Water Trail, making stops at Norrie Point, Cold Spring, Yonkers, and several other locations. The paddlers invite you to join them for day paddles or for the series of onshore festivals at each put-in site. For more information, email info@greathudsonriverpaddle.net. That's info@greathudsonriverpaddle.net.
Next week, Jonathan Kruk tells us tales of how some places along the Hudson got their names. We speak with historical folk singer Rich Balla about a favorite song of ours, 50 Sail on Newburgh Bay. And we hear the story of one woman's moonlit encounter with a swarm of eels in a seemingly unlikely place, off West 79th Street in New York City, to be exact. All this and more on the Hudson River. For this week's Hudson River Soundscape, we hear an outtake that never made it onto Anaya Lockwood's recording, A Sound Map of the Hudson. She takes us to the North River, which flows into the Hudson in the Adirondacks. The Hudson River Radio program is produced in association with Vassar College, its Environmental Studies program, and its Journalism Forum. Our student assistant producers are digital editor Sean Anderson and researcher and editor Batsheva Ghez. Vassar College professor Randy Cornelius is the project director. I'm your host, Mark Breslov, producer and project manager. This project has been funded in part by a grant from the New York State Environmental Protection Fund through the Hudson River Estuary Program. Special thanks to Fran Dunwell and Steve Stan of the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Additional support for this program comes from Vassar College, with thanks to Susan Kuiper. Thanks also to Steve Rath. To listen to this program again or for more information, visit www.hudsonriver.vassar.edu. Email us at hudsonriver@vassar.edu.